The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, welcome to a Friday. I'm Nicole Sandler here at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network. And I hate being right sometimes, but I told you yesterday when the news was out about Marco Rubio being a no on the GOP tax scam bill, not to hold your breath. He likes to get his name out there. And sure enough, what he said he was against it for was that he was holding out for an increased child tax credit. So in the final draft of the bill, which is not even out yet, apparently it'll be released at around 5:30 Eastern this afternoon, right, Friday night. What they did was they increased it from $1,100 to $1,400. $300 whopping dollars. That's all it took to get Marco Rubio's vote back. So Marco Rubio is now a yes. And the usual sources say that now it looks like they've got the votes to pass this monstrosity. So there's that. They're looking at voting on it next week and having it on the president's desk before Christmas. So, gee, aren't we lucky? Yeah. I do have a little gift for you, though, a Friday afternoon gift. Since it is Friday, I thought we'd start with a song, this in honor of yesterday's news, and heed the warning, the disclaimer that I play at the beginning of the show, if you will. It's Eric Idle of Monty Python. Here we go.
Fuck you very much, the FCC. Fuck you very much for fining me. $5,000 a fuck, so I'm really out of luck. That's more than Heidi Fleiss was charging me. So fuck you very much, the FCC, for proving that free speech just isn't free. Clear Channel's a dear channel, so Howard Stern must go. Attorney General Ashcroft doesn't like strong words, and so he's charging twice as much as all the drugs for Rush Limbaugh. So fuck you all so very much. So fuck you very much, dear Mr. Bush, for heroically sitting on your tush. For Halliburton, Enron, all the companies who fail, let's send them a clear signal and stick Martha straight in jail. She's an uppity rich bitch, and at least she isn't male. So fuck you all so very much. So fuck you, dickhead Mr. Cheney too. Fuck you and fuck everything you do. Your pacemaker must be a fake, you haven't got a heart. As far as I'm concerned, you're just a pasty-faced old fart. And as for Condoleezza, she's an intellectual tart. So fuck you all so very much. So fuck you very much, the EPA, for giving all Alaska's oil away. It really is a bummer when I can't fill my Hummer. The ozone's a no-go zone now that Arnold's here to say
the nuclear winter games are going to take place in L.A.
So fuck you all so very much. So what, the planet fails? Let's save the great white males. And fuck you all so very much.
Obviously, a tune from the Bush era, but oh, it all holds up so beautifully today. And in the news, with the news of the FCC undoing our net neutrality rules, the internet yesterday was begging Eric Idle for some updated lyrics, and he he delivered. In fact, he even responded to some on Twitter who asked for the new lyrics with the new lyrics. So the new verse goes, "Fuck you very much, the FCC, for kindly ending net neutrality. The country's in the toilet now that Putin took a dump all over your democracy and left you all with Trump." Now he just needs to re-record it with a few more lyrics and we'd all be set. Oh, boy. Yes, it is. It's one of those weeks. So, you know, last night I was watching TV. I actually had Chris Hayes on for a while, and I was interested to watch because he was having this guy, Addie Barkin, on. If you hadn't heard of Addie Barkin, he is a, I think he's around 33 years old. He's a young father of a little boy who suffers from ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And a video of him on an airplane talking to Senator Jeff Flake went sort of semi-viral, of him trying to extract some humanity out of Jeff Flake. Not that there was much to be found there, but this guy, Addie Barkin, is one passionate, strong, tough guy. And he was on again with Chris Hayes last night. I want to share some of this with you.
The Republicans say, when you talk about PAYGO, so the idea is right now in law, when revenue goes down, you got to cut social spending. It's called PAYGO. And they say, don't worry about that. We're going to get that waived. All the cuts that you, Adi, are concerned about, all the cuts people out there are right. concerned about, trust us, it's not going to happen. Do you not trust
Two
them?
2 points. You're a joker, Chris. You are. 2 points. One, who in their right mind would ever trust Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, and Donald Trump? Because remember, Donald Trump has to sign that waiver of PAYGO.
Yep. Right.
How many times a day does he lie for his own enrichment and advancement? So no, nobody trusts them and nobody should. And two, Ryan is going around saying next up on the chopping block is Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security. So how can they say we're gonna waive PAYGO, but we're also gonna cut the living daylights out of this thing? It makes no sense. But Chris, can I just make a request to the American people? Because this really is an opportunity for folks to step up and reclaim our democracy. This building belongs to us. This Congress is ours. We have to renew our faith in our ability as a people to stand up for what we believe in and to change the course of this country. We can't allow Donald Trump and his lying son and selfish sons to rip families apart, to steal our money, to take our health care away. It's up to us to stand up. Look, it was hard for me to come here. I'm disabled. It's been a really hard year. And there were people here with me fighting by my side. Megan Anderson, she's almost totally paralyzed. She flew here from Cincinnati by herself. I mean, the lengths she went to fight. So I'm asking tonight, all Americans who care about this, stand up with me on Monday. It's my birthday. I don't know how many birthdays I have left. Stand up with me. Go to www.stopgoptaxscam.com. Chris, please have your producers put it up. Stopgoptaxscam.com. Come to Washington. Raise your voices. Be a part of the great American experiment in democracy. It's up to us to make it work. If we don't do it, K Street wins. If we don't raise our voices, the money wins. The only thing we have is people power. And if you can't come to D.C., do it in your home district. Go to indivisibleguide.com and do it in your own district. Sorry, I'm filibustering, you know, Chris. It just matters so much.
I know, and you've earned the right to do it. If anyone has, I admire what you're doing, Addie Barkin. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris.
Addie Barkin. He's an activist and obviously a passionate activist for what he believes in. This GOP tax scam bill now looking like it has the votes to pass. Thank you, Marco Rubio. Always knew you'd come through, as you did. What a shame. We've got a big show for you today. An old friend of the show, Harvey J.K., is back with us to talk about the mistakes the Democrats have made in the past and questioning if they're making them again and what they need to do to turn things around in the future. He'll join us in a few minutes, but first we've got to look at what's news.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The Federal Communications Commission voted 3-2 on Thursday to repeal net neutrality protections. The decision is a blow for consumers and a win for internet service companies like Verizon, Comcast, and AT&T, which gain the power to dramatically reshape and limit the way Americans access the internet. Under the new rules, internet service providers could slow access to competitors, effectively making sites aligned with the company or ones who pay their way out of slow lanes load faster. Over 56 million American households have no choice of internet service providers in their area, leaving them potentially tethered to an artificially slow internet under the new rules. One of the two Democrats on the commission, Mignon Clyburn, was emphatic in her opposition.
I know that there are many questions on the minds of Americans right now, including what the repeal of net neutrality will mean for them. To help understand or to answer or address outstanding questions, I plan to host a town hall through Twitter next week on Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. But what saddens me the most today is that the agency that is supposed to protect you is actually abandoning you. But what I am pleased to be able to say today is that the fight to save net neutrality does not end today. The agency does not have the final word. Thank goodness for that. And as I close my eulogy of the 2015 net neutrality rules, carefully crafted rules that actually struck an appropriate balance in providing consumer protections and enabling opportunities and investment, I actually take what I'll just call ironic comfort in the words of then Commissioner Pai back in 2015, because I believe this will ring true about this destroying internet freedom order. I am optimistic, he said, that we will look back on today's vote as an aberration, a temporary deviation from the bipartisan path that has served us so well. I don't know whether this plan will be vacated by a court, reversed by Congress, or overturned by a future commission, but I do believe that its days are numbered. Amen to that, Mr. Chairman. Amen to that.
Senator Marco Rubio of Florida has told Senate leaders that he'll vote against the tax bill unless the child tax credit is made more generous. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about the latest development in the White House press briefing on Thursday.
Taxes, you've got two no's in the Senate so far. You've got Senator Corker, who's been a no for a while. Senator Rubio came out and told us a short time ago that he's a no unless he can get an expansion of the child tax credit. Is the president willing to be a little more generous in the child tax credit in order to get Senator Rubio's vote?
Look, we're really proud of the work that we've done already up until this point with Senator Rubio, already doubling the child tax credit, taking it to $2,000 per child. We're going to continue working with the senator, but we think we've made great strides.
It's $1,400, not $2,000.
Movement in terms of the child tax credit. We're very proud of that work. We're going to keep working with them until we get the job done, which we still expect to happen before the end of the year.
Senator Mike Lee of Utah is now also undecided on the bill for the same reason. Bob Corker of Tennessee voted against the original Senate bill because it would add to the deficit, and he suggests his concerns have not changed. Republicans can only lose two votes and still pass their bill. Voting is expected as soon as next week. Politico ran a story Thursday suggesting that Paul Ryan is seriously considering stepping down from Congress after the 2018 election, a story that CNN picked up on.
The speaker has made very clear over the course of the last couple of months, really, frankly, since before he was even Speaker of the House, when he was named as a possible choice to replace Speaker John Boehner, that this wasn't the job that he necessarily wanted. He did end up taking the job. And as it currently stands, he has been having discussions with some of his close confidants about the possibility that he would leave Congress at the end of this term. term. Now, it's worth noting, the Speaker, earlier today, walking out of the Capitol, said this.
So you're not quitting anytime soon?
I'm not. No.
Pretty declarative there. The Speaker's office also putting out a statement saying that he doesn't plan on leaving. But just for the context here, because this part is important, the Speaker has made clear repeatedly that his dream job was essentially the House Ways and Means Chairman. He was a policy guy. That's where he wanted to focus. The idea of leading and wrangling the House was always something that maybe he didn't necessarily want to do, even though he was willing to do it when he was asked to do just that. So the big question now becomes, if Republicans complete the tax overhaul, something that has long been a goal of the Speaker's, would he be willing to end his time in office after that point? Now, I want to note that our reporting is coming in the wake of a Politico report that made very clear that these considerations were a possibility, were something that might happen. Obviously, again, must say, the Speaker has said he's not going anywhere at this point. But these are conversations that have occurred. The realities are that the job takes quite a toll on his family. The Speaker has noted that publicly many times. And the job itself is a very complex and difficult one at that. As of now, no final decision has been made. But as we're reporting, those conversations have occurred. And I will note that they have also, in the rumors about those conversations, stories about those conversations, have percolated throughout the House Republican Conference. People trying to figure out what might come next. People might trying to figure out who might come next.
And that's a bit of What's News for Now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider a contribution. My work is 100% listener-funded, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate. The story about Paul Ryan possibly retiring is a really good one. Of course, there's massive pushback from his office. We'll have to wait and see what happens with that. But then again, John Boehner pushed back on the idea that he'd be retiring up until the night before he did. So, you know, that one we've got some hope on. All right. For a bit more news, we turn to our friends at the Talk Media News Service. They're at talkmedianews.com. Luke Vargas is the chief foreign correspondent. Hey there, Luke.
Hey there. Good afternoon.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's the UN Correspondents Association dinner gala tonight. So kind of like our folks down in D.C. get there, crack at it. And I guess it wasn't as fun for them this year without the president being there. But we've got our own kind of version of that coming up. So once we get off the phone, I'm going to put on a tux and fly away on my broom.
Oh, boy. So they combine a holiday party along with the thing honoring the UN correspondents at the same time.
Yes. And take a guess. Nikki Haley is not going to be there. She's ducking out of this one. I don't think it's going to be a terribly receptive crowd. So anyways, we'll party without her.
Okay. You'll have more fun anyway.
No, I'm looking forward to it.
So today the UN Security Council met again, dealing with North Korea.
Yeah, what was different about this is that Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, came up, and it's been a particularly odd week for him. Maybe it's the most diplomatic way of saying that. I mean, it began on a kind of a good note. On Tuesday, Tillerson gave a speech at the Atlantic Council down in Washington, D.C., in which for the first time he really seemed to suggest that the U.S. was open to negotiations with North Korea. Mm-hmm. And you know, having just come back from that corner of the world, I mean, there's a huge overwhelming consensus in South Korea, at least, and also in Japan to a large extent, that we really do need to figure out a way to get to the negotiating table, that the sanctions that we are putting on North Korea are not an end in and of themselves. They are only a means to try and push North Korea to the negotiating table. And there's quite a lot of evidence that suggests sanctions aren't even the right way to do that. But that's at least the argument the U.S. seems to believe, but it's not widely shared with others. And so it was very heartening, I think, to folks from around the world who are very rightfully concerned about the way that this crisis has been militarized rhetorically by President Trump and many of his senior advisors. It was great that Tillerson came out. He gave this speech in which he said, you know, let's sit down. We can talk about the weather if we want. We can talk about the shape of the table that we're going to talk at. But the important part is that we get to the negotiating table, and the U.S. isn't going to put any preconditions on that, at least for the first round. And that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. You know, you do need to get that exposure with your counterpart and start learning about what their demands are and what their flexibility is, it would seem, before you'd want to rule out that prospect of talks altogether. And so that was a really great statement on Tuesday. And then it didn't take 10 hours or 12 hours until the White House came out on Wednesday morning and said, that's absolutely not our position. we believe North Korea needs to demonstrate a dismantling of its nuclear and missile programs before we begin talks. When that's sort of right back to the position we were at before, and that's the position the administration has kept articulating. And that's an incredibly high demand. Telling North Korea, as President Trump did when he was in South Korea a few weeks ago, that you've got to completely, irreversibly, and verifiably dismantle the entire nuclear and missile program before we talk is, right. It's like, it's the one thing they don't want to do. So how can you convince the world and North Korea that you're a good faith negotiator if you're putting such a high precondition on even speaking? And so what we saw today, and there was a lot of eyes on Tillerson during his big speech at the UN today, is, you know, reverting right back to the, you know, same old Trump administration line. It seems that he has really had, you know, the rug pulled out from underneath him.
Right.
Maybe he was trying to create a new avenue on Tuesday and see if the administration would go along with this. And by all indications, they slapped him down. He came out today and he said, look, they're going to need to earn their way back to the negotiating table. We're going to need to see, you know, evidence there. Don't want to be a destabilizing force anymore. That's all code for, you know, you do everything first before we even talk.
Right.
It would be a privilege to engage in diplomacy with the United States. So, you know, Tillerson's pretty lame ducky today. That was on full display.
Obviously. There were questions on Tuesday as to whether or not he had the administration's authority to say what he said about going to the table with no preconditions. And now I guess we know the answer.
Well, and he went beyond that on Tuesday. I mean, what I thought was, it was really just like hearing what a lot of people in the foreign policy community want to hear coming out of a man they didn't expect to hear it from.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it seemed like a, you know, sort of like a gun down some wormhole or something. And Tillerson, even further, the quote that really grabbed me of what he said on Tuesday was that, you know, it would be irresponsible of us to say that we need them, North Korea, to give up their nuclear program before we talk, because they've spent so much time and energy on it. He's not applauding them for that, but he's acknowledging the obvious that they've invested. I mean, this is their number one goal. And it seemed like a really plain, if not somewhat, I don't know. I feel like there's a hesitation on the part of the U.S. And it goes back before the Trump administration, a hesitancy to admit that the North Koreans have achieved what they wanted to achieve, because it would be humiliating to us, that it would be an admission that our policy here failed. And so when Tillerson on Tuesday said, you know, it's not realistic to say we're only going to talk if you come to the table ready to give up your program because they have too much invested in it. That just seemed really honest and just a level of candor that we haven't seen from this administration. But again, he ping-ponged back today, and we're back to the Trump administration.
Amazing.
Policy of just not being interested in diplomacy.
Amazing.
At all, it seems.
Yeah, yesterday, the president spoke with Vladimir Putin, and he was saying he's hoping to get Russia's help on North Korea. He said, we've got China's help, do we?
No, I mean, so once again, like Tillerson here is just speaking either out of step or doesn't know what he's talking about. I mean, so his speech today, he specifically criticized the Russians and the Chinese. And you're right. I mean, Trump has been the one in his tweets who repeatedly swings between saying the Chinese aren't doing enough to then the day after, the hour after he gets off the phone with them, saying that they've promised full cooperation and they're doing a great job. And so you're right. I mean, yeah, I saw that readout of the calls yesterday. He was, you know, harsh on Russia. Tillerson was harsh on Russia today. He said, look, they're employing a bunch of North Koreans in these work camps. They're, you know, giving them cash, and that cash goes right back home. It's sort of like sending back remittances, but instead of going to families, it goes to the government. So that's a valid criticism. But, you know, Tillerson today said, look, the Chinese, we've seen an uptick in the amount of oil they're sending to China. And that's a huge part of sanctions, something that they're not pulling their weight on. So again, I want to believe that Tillerson has some sort of diplomatic independence within this administration, because at times he appears to be, and I say this with, you know, a lot of asterisks next to it, but he appears to be a sort of voice of reason at times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he is taking these issues seriously. I mean, he really is trying to learn on the job in a way that I don't think we've seen a lot of evidence that President Trump is trying to do that.
No.
So, you know, whenever he goes out ahead of Trump, it's exciting. It makes people in the foreign policy world think that maybe U.S. policy is going to get a little bit more coherent. And then, of course, Trump starts speaking and that, that dream disappears pretty quickly.
Right. And then we're hearing that Tillerson's on his way out and Mike Pompeo is going to take over at State. And Tom Tillis is going to come in as head of the CIA to replace Pompeo. So who knows? It's chaos, which is the way Trump likes it.
And the stability within the administration, you know, for folks who are wary of a military outcome here, are the military people. I mean, they are the folks around President Trump who seem to a combination of flatter him, but also sort of impress him with their medals and gold stars and all that sort of mm-hmm. thing. And it's of concern, I think, that there are so many military figures who are so central to the president's decision making and who are filling roles that have really hardly ever been filled by military brass in the past. And none of their jobs seem to be in question in quite the way that the, you know, political figures in the American foreign policy world seem to always have, you know, an axe hanging over their head like Tillerson.
That's true. He likes his generals.
You know, it's been talked about that it's some sort of, and I don't want to do armchair psychology here, but there, you know, there is something to be said about, you know, Trump having gone to, I guess, a military boarding school and sort of having kind of a reverence for that culture of discipline. And I don't know, it's probably also worth pointing out, they may be less hesitant to push back on him,
right,
you know, given they're more aware of the chain of command. And unlike someone like Tillerson, who's quite used to being the boss of a mm-hmm. company that in many ways rivals the geographic scope of American foreign policy, that it sort of starts to make sense why if Trump pushes back on these officials like Tillerson and maybe doesn't get as much lip, if you will, from the military leaders who are still right by his side and seem to be pushing him again further and further towards, you know, military options toward North Korea.
Okay. Yeah. And that scares the hell out of me. So what else is going on, Luke?
Well, this is pretty cool. Also from the United Nations, but I think much more of interest to sort of the domestic political audience is there's a UN official who just got back from a 2-week tour of the United States. And he is the UN's lead expert on extreme poverty and human rights. And he went to California. He went to the Deep South, to Alabama, to Georgia. He visited Puerto Rico and Appalachia, West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave a scathing report today on American policies relating to inequality and poverty. And, you know, I'm trying to think. I haven't looked at how other outlets have covered this. I'm sure, and this is not in any way dig at Mother Jones or anything, but I'm sure there's an article up there that just says, oh my God, the UN is laying into the Trump administration and the Republican tax plan. They are, but I almost feel like they would probably be understating this because I have been here for 5 years and there are regularly UN reports about, you know, trying to put the situation in America in a global context. And by far, this is the most extreme one I have ever seen where it really is a skies are falling type of assessment here. And I think what sets it apart, too, is that this man, Philip Alston, who did this report, really tried to make an effort to understand the way we talk about these issues in the United States. You know, he's not applying like a I'm from Switzerland, I'm a, you know, European bureaucrat type of perspective here and writing about this in kind of a cold and detached way. He's using, you know, the American political language to try and make this make sense to other people. And one of the big takeaways he had is he condemned the tax bill, and I'll talk about that in a second. But he said he was really struck, and this is I'm going to kind of quote here for a few sentences because I thought this was really powerful. He said, I was struck by the extent to which caricatured narratives about the purported innate differences between the rich and poor have been sold to the American electorate by politicians and the media and have been allowed to define the debate. The rich are industrious, entrepreneurial, patriotic, and the drivers of economic success, while the poor are wasters, losers, and scammers. So as a result, money spent on welfare in America is money down the drain. To complete the picture, we are also told that the poor who want to make it in America can easily do so. They really can achieve the American dream if only they work hard enough. And I again, this is maybe I'll send you a link to this so you
okay,
can share it
please.
With your listeners. But
That'd
this is 18 pages of a really great sort of nonpartisan and again, it takes a lot of digs at the conservatives in the United States, but I find this sort of 10,000 foot view of what's going on in America and comparing it to a lot of other countries around the world to be quite refreshing. And he's, you know, he takes issue with the tax bill. He says this tax reform package working its way through Congress stakes out America's bid to become the most unequal society in the world, and the dramatic cuts in welfare that President Trump and Speaker Ryan are foreshadowing and trying to implement will essentially shred crucial dimensions of a safety net that is already full of holes. So again, I just found it refreshing to hear a UN expert not stick to the old language here and really try to understand what's going on here in the United States, and in particular, you know, demonization of taxation as a viable policy tool. A lot of work here where he consulted with some other criminal justice experts talking about how, you know, the American justice system is increasingly being used as a way of financing police departments and the justice system. You know, we're putting in homeless people, we're putting in low-level offenders and charging them so many fines and things like that, that basically bankrupts them, but also feeds government coffers. It's a pretty scathing report, but one that I was really quite struck by. And I'm quite proud of the United Nations and its independence, even though it's bureaucratic and,
right.
and often.
Well, good on them for doing this.
That's some bad, but for this kind of like candid analysis of the social dynamics in the U.S., I thought this was great.
Well, that's an important piece of work, and please do send me the link, and I'll put it on the blog today along with the podcast of today's show so people can read it. Because honestly, I haven't seen a word about it anywhere since.
I beat everyone to it. I mean, I like to read these things. It's a cool mechanism, and it, again, doesn't make me surprised to hear that the U.S. is thinking about pulling out of the U.N. Human Rights Council because it's independent, it's edgy. Of course, there are a preponderance, and it is quite tilted. A huge number of anti-Israel resolutions that go through there. I mean, I think you could probably communicate the same displeasure with Israeli policy in about a 20th of the same of that number of resolutions. Mm-hmm. But you know, it makes them an easy target. But that said, they maintain this list. It's probably about two dozen people. They call them special rapporteurs, and they each have another mandate. So one person is extreme poverty. One is access to water. They had someone go to Flint a few years ago, and they go around all these countries and they just look at it from a single lens and publish these reports, and they ask governments to open up prisons for them, open up water treatment plants, or go to homeless shelters and things like that. And this report, which really pulled in all these cool glimpses of American society, is a good one.
Hopefully there'll be some coverage of it besides just yours, your excellent coverage. Luke Vargas of the Talk Media News Service. Thank you so much, Luke. Have a wonderful weekend, and I'll look out for your email.
Thanks, Nicole. Bye-bye. Right,
take care. Bye-bye. All right. Our old pal Harvey J.K. is here. So let's take a very quick break, and we'll be back with Harvey next.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
Well, where is he?
Where is who?
Where is Harvey?
Oh, you mean Harvey J.K.
Yeah, Harvey.
Well, he's coming up right now on the Nicole Sandler Show.
Harvey was a regular on this show for a long time. He's a professor of democracy and justice at the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay and author of a couple of great books, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America and the Fight for the Four Freedoms. It's been a while since he's joined us, but with all that's going on in our country, I thought it was time to hear from Professor K. Hello, Harvey.
Hello, Nicole. Am I okay coming through?
You are coming through loud and clear. How are you doing?
Okay, physically I'm doing fine. Spiritually and politically, it leaves a lot to be desired right now.
And you're not alone. I'm telling you, I've had serious, mental health issues, I think, since this election. It's been just over a year, almost a year, since Trump took office, and he's really taking a toll.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it seems like every single day he figures out another way to distract the media. And the Republicans continually not only defer to him, but they abet him. I mean, he's been a very useful tool for them as this tax scam bill demonstrates.
That's so true. And now, of course, you know, yesterday,
since
whoops,
this election,
whoops, hold on,
just over a
yesterday,
year,
some,
almost a year
wow,
since Trump took
hold
office.
On. And yesterday, some people were holding out hope that Marco Rubio was going to be a no vote because he said something about the child tax credit. So they upped it by $300 and now he's good to go. And it's looking like it's going through. This is going to hurt a lot of people for generations to come.
Oh, yeah. No, in fact, you know, this hope, you know, the hope that Marco Rubio was going to somehow dissent. What do they call it? Grasping at straws?
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, weeks ago, Ron Johnson said he couldn't support the tax
exactly.
bill because it didn't benefit small business. And we all knew in Wisconsin that he was just full of it, that there was no way he was going to buck the GOP. I mean, this is, you know, partly they do it so that people remember that something about them that didn't seem quite as scurrilous as they really are. I mean, that's all I can imagine.
Right. Harvey, the other day you sent me, yesterday, I guess it was, you sent me a column from the New York Times by Brett Stevens. The headline read, "Democrats are walking into a Trumpian trap." Do you think we are?
Well, let's put it this way. I mean, Brett Stevens is no progressive, obviously.
No, not at all.
He's a conservative. Mm-hmm. But what is interesting is he reviewed the situation. You know, things look good, he says, to both, you know, progressives and to disillusioned conservatives. The victories, you know, such as in Alabama, the fact that Me Too has been so successful. He's laid out a whole series of things. And the polls seem to indicate that the Democrats are, what, 10 to 20 points ahead of Republicans in some kind of generic situation. But then he warns of something, which I think has a great deal of historical evidence behind it. And that is that Americans are willing to forgive sex. I mean, you know, look what happened with Bill Clinton.
They have. Well, they were. But I think that was a different time. I think we've reached some kind of fever pitch here where and I can't believe that I'm saying this because I am a feminist and I do believe in a woman's right to be heard and to be respected. But some things I think are just beyond the pale. There was one of the allegations against one of the latest batch. I can't even remember who it was. And one of the accusations was that the person in question used vulgar language. Now, come on. That's taking it a bit too far. It
yeah.
was just like
yeah,
the last yeah. accusation against Al Franken by someone who calls herself a progressive is that he grabbed her waist when they were taking a picture together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they're right. No, I definitely understand what you're saying. And I don't mean they forgive sex generically. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I do think at the same time, one of my colleagues said, are we not in some kind of moral panic? Which has something to it. But I think what we have to consider, one of the checks on my thinking is the fact that 48% of the Alabama electorate, which I know was a generally reactionary electorate, 48% of them still voted for Moore. And I think what's fundamental is if we look closely at how Jones won, it's really important to understand the degree to which African Americans turned out to vote. And I think that had to do not only with the morality question, I think it had to do with the fact that they fully recognize that the guy is a reactionary white supremacist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think there are grounds for mobilizing that. Don't get me wrong. I'm just referring to what he had to say. I mean, this his sort of warning that we should be careful. And most importantly, he says the economic numbers are up. Okay, I mean, unemployment.
Yep.
Sorry, let's put it this way. Government reporting of unemployment shows that unemployment is down.
Right.
And obviously the stock market is soaring. Remember, I'm just reporting what he's saying right now. Now, having said all of that, while I'm not prepared to subscribe to his arguments, I do think that we ought to be thinking seriously about them. So, for example, let's go back. I mean, let's go back to, say, the 1970s.
Okay.
In the wake of the Watergate scandals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Watergate may not seem to many people as significant as collusion with the Russians and maybe treachery on a scale beyond that. But it is the case that Watergate smashed the Republicans and the Democrats were really able to take advantage of that and elect Jimmy Carter in 1976, in spite of the fact that in the previous go rounds, the Democrats looked like they would never recover. Now, here's my point. Jimmy Carter, you know, led the Democratic Party in a direction that no progressive could be happy. I mean, he turned his back on the consumer rights movement. He turned his back on labor. He turned his back on the environmentalists. So I mean, we should be careful that in that this is now me speaking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We should be careful in assuming that because the Republicans have been doing such ill and that Trump is such a vile figure and a vile character, and that most Americans are utterly turned off by him and utterly pissed off by this tax bill, we shouldn't necessarily think that we can coast into this election. That's my starting place, okay?
Right.
And especially progressives, I mean, we're going to hear a lot. We've already been hearing it. Look, all this talk of Joe Biden, you hear it, right?
Yes.
I mean, we should be careful about the degree to which we progressives get roped into running behind whoever the Democrats of these last number of years put forward. Right now, it's important for progressives to be speaking very clearly about what Americans really do need and what we ought to be speaking to. And let me give you an example of what I mean.
Okay.
I mean, you can recall my previous times on, I have harped on the fact that the Democrats really offer no story. They offer no narrative.
And that's always, okay? that's the criticism of them is that, you know, all the Democrats are about now is being against Trump, but they're not offering
right.
What they're for.
Right. So I would urge the Democrats in their caucuses, in their conventions, in their conferences, in every venue, to be thinking about how to turn to American history and learn from their own experience. The best examples, obviously, are, you know, Franklin Roosevelt and the Kennedy-Johnson years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are the best examples. What did they push? And what did they push? They pushed economic security. They pushed Social Security and later Medicare and Medicaid. They pushed the idea, especially under Roosevelt and those who followed him, full employment. Now, let me explain something about what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm.
So the figures show that unemployment is down. The problem with that is it's in some ways it's ignoring a really fundamental feature of the employment picture. So, for example, the what do they call it? The there's a term for this, the prime age labor force participation rate, which sounds kind of fancy. Prime age labor force participation rate. That's 25 to 50 year olds. We've seen a significant decline over the years. We're down 4 million workers, men and women. Well, 4 percentage points for men, 3 percentage points for women. What this totals is basically 4 million fewer workers in that age cohort of 25 to 54. That means there are a lot of people out there who might well respond, and the Democrats have a history of committing themselves to a full employment picture. Now, what I'm saying here is Democrats need to go social democratic. They need to say that if we're going to address the needs of Americans, we need public action to do it, and we're going to guarantee work one way or the other, and along with that work, we will guarantee the health care necessary to secure it. And those are the kinds of words we need to hear, not just impeach, yes, and all of that. But these Republicans are there in Congress doing serious damage to the future. And you can bet, I mean, I think this is where you were about to go a moment ago. You can bet that once they run up the deficit, as they're going to run up the deficit in a villainous way.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the opportunity arises, they're all of a sudden going to become deficit hawks, and they're going to talk about cutting entitlements. In fact, I do believe it was no more than 2 weeks ago that Paul Ryan said, well, once we get the tax, you know, scam bill passed, that's my words, not his. Once we do that, what we need to do is look at entitlements.
Yep.
I mean, he's already setting it up. And by the way, if Paul Ryan goes, it's only because he really it's possible he wants a political future and he doesn't want to be the guy who's running Congress or at least leading the Republicans if they lose Congress. I mean, I think they've got long-term, look, they've been doing this for 40 years, this class war, and right now this tax scam bill, in some ways it's the climactic moment after which they're just going to clean up the residue of things. So, you know, they'll pass some kind of national right to work bill. They'll go after Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, they're already going to basically deflate the possibilities of any growth in Obamacare by taking away the mandate,
mm-hmm.
you know, mandatory requirement. And they're going to go after Social Security as well. I mean, they are scurrilous. You know, they are so vile and so they're liars and they're thieves. And we need to figure out not only how to criticize them, we need to offer a story, a vision, and then out of that story and vision, an agenda. And I think, and a few of my colleagues and I have been talking about this, that full employment might be the starting place for that.
Well, we are technically at full employment. When you have unemployment at 4.1%, that's full employment.
Right.
But you're talking about, are you talking about how job guarantees? This is something that I was talking about with Howie Klein yesterday. This is a theory of modern monetary theory believes in the idea of guaranteed jobs for everyone, not a guaranteed minimum income. That's
right.
a different animal, but guaranteed jobs. So if you are able to work, we've got a job for you.
And in fact, if I can just say, I don't support the minimum income idea in part because it could set up a situation that it'll be viewed as charity and
right.
they'll rip it off.
Exactly.
Of people. Yeah. No, I think it's really crucial that we think in terms of guaranteed work, full employment. And it's not necessarily the case that we have to think of the government as an employer of last resort. In some ways, they want to be the employer of first resort in light of the fact that who's talking about the infrastructure these days?
Well,
who's talking about the bridges and the highways and the tunnels and all that stuff?
Well, supposedly that's coming up on this Republican agenda. Can you imagine, Harvey Kay, how different things might have been if they had started with infrastructure, with a big infrastructure bill, instead of trying to do Obamacare?
I can tell you, I was absolutely convinced. You know, my only problem is occasionally I actually think that other people are as smart as we are.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things is I figured Trump, look, the guy became president. I figured if he's really smart, the first thing he does is goes the infrastructure direction. They even had a plan as to how to do infrastructure by way of giving over the infrastructure to the capitalist business folks.
Right, to do public-private partnerships, which is what the plan is if they ever get there anyway. But I think it'll be more public, more private than public, because there's no public money left.
Yeah, and there's another thing. I don't know if you've had a chance in the last year or so to talk to John Nichols, his previous book on robots. You know, robots are coming to take our jobs, which he's not paranoid about that. Well, if you think about the near future, I mean, robots are going to take over a lot of the very basic kinds of labor. I mean, cities and towns have competed for Amazon warehouses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And distribution centers.
Mm-hmm.
The folks who get those jobs, they'll be out in 5 years. I mean, robots will take those jobs.
Right. Robots, not robots per se, but technology destroyed the radio industry. I mean, now you have what's known as voice tracking. It took the jobs of hundreds of thousands of people because one person can sit in a studio and be the on-air personality at dozens of radio stations around the country, you know, knock out five stations in the matter of an hour or two and just push a button and the voice tracks go, and then the computer runs the whole thing. That's why my industry has been decimated.
Right. Well, I can tell you that I was meeting with people these last few years. You know, all these for-profit colleges that have grown up. I mean, what they do is they basically get packages, educational packages, and then they hire people with maybe master's degrees to offer these things. So they get the PhDs who've trained to write their own death knell, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, to orchestrate their own death knell. Then they hire people with master's degrees or maybe even bachelor's degrees, or they offer it online. And basically, you know, they can update that regularly because people will be out of jobs and they'll be desperately seeking some kind of work. No, I mean, somebody said to me, well, if all the corporations are looking to put workers out in favor of robots and technological advances, what are they going to do with all these unemployed workers? And I said jokingly, but the kids are too young to remember, I said, "What is it? Remember the old Soylent Green?"
Mm-hmm. It's people. Soylent Green is people.
It's people, yeah. We really do need to master the rhetoric and master the story and the vision as soon as we can. And we can't rely on people's animosities towards Trump to sustain it. Not to mention, we have to start building not just for 2018, we have to build for 2020, 2024. We've got to really sort of take charge of this stuff. Most Americans are on our side, but we have to figure out a way to speak to them.
Right. But you know what, Harvey, there's breaking news. Bob Corker has now announced he will vote for the final tax scam bill. So it's over. They've got the votes,
I'm sorry, I'm laughing through my tears right now. This is
right.
unfucking believable.
Right. Because here's the guy who, you know, said, oh, if it adds a dime to the deficit, they will not have my vote. He's not running for reelection. He's out. He's got no, you know, he doesn't have to be loyal to anybody. And yet he caved on this piece of shit. And, you know,
there must be blackmail. There's got to be a blackmail case here.
Do they have against him?
I don't know. I mean, it's just hard to figure out. But I have no doubt this, they're holding something over his head. There's no way he'd shift at this moment. You're absolutely right. He's not running again for the election.
Right. He's got no loyalty to Trump. There's nothing, no reason at all he should vote for this. And what's going to happen is the Democrats get back in power in 2020 and in 2024. That's when all the bad stuff from this bill starts kicking in. Because in 2025, the way it's written, that's when the individual tax cuts go away. The corporate tax cuts stay in place. Those are permanent.
Well, I have on a cruder level,
yes.
Although I've already used the F-bomb, as some
That's
people
fine.
Call it, I can tell you that I've been tweeting something, and people think I'm joking, and I'm really quite serious. And anybody out there who's interested in following me, it's at Harvey JK. So what I've been tweeting is, Dems, you want to appeal to workers? For starters, recognize 40 years of class war and direct your middle fingers at the corporate classes. And then I've got, you know, the finger up in the air. I mean, the Democrats are going to have to be willing to bite the hand that's fed them too. I mean, there's just no question about it.
Right. And there are some in the Democratic caucus and the House and the Senate who are just as bad as the Republicans. That's the problem. And as we learn every week, especially with Howie Klein on this program, the leadership in the Democratic Party are putting up the worst of the worst. The Republican light candidates who go along with this kind of stuff. Now that they've got the votes from the Republicans, I wouldn't be surprised to see some Democrats jump in and vote for it as well, some of those in red states who are afraid that otherwise they're going to lose.
Yeah, and they'll have gotten permission from Schumer to do it so that they can, you know. Yeah. Oh, man. How much time we got left here?
We've got almost 10 minutes.
Yeah, you know, I've just been in agony these days. It seems like, you know, there was that brief respite on Tuesday night with the Alabama election. You know, and undeniably, that's grasping at straws. But I do expect Democrats to win victories. Now, but here's what I worried about as we were in the vein of that other conversation. Is that they passed this tax cut bill, right? Mm-hmm. And then in the new year, as you're saying, maybe they do turn to the infrastructure plan. And there's no way the Democrats can then block infrastructure spending.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, the Republicans and Trump in particular look like they're doing things for working people.
Yeah.
I mean, they're doing stuff for working people. So the Democrats better get, they need some kind of dynamic. You know, let me ask you something, as opposed to you asking me, let me ask you something.
Okay.
So right now, is Bernie young? I know how old he is, but is Bernie young enough to run again?
You know what? I don't think it's about his age. I think at this point it's too. I love Bernie. I'd love nothing more than to see him president, but he should be president now. I think we're too fractured to have him run. I think he's too damaged by the ugliness, not so much from the campaign, but from the aftermath of the campaign.
Oh yeah, right. Because my colleagues and I, we sit at lunch and we say, well, who's on the horizon?
Well, that's the question.
And the folks that generally come up because of media talk are all people who are basically, you know, they're the new renditions of the Clinton machine.
Yes. You got Kirsten Gillibrand. And I'm sorry,
I'm still
miffed at her over the Al Franken thing, because I think Al Franken was set up to take a fall. There's Cory Booker, who is Wall Street's best friend.
Yes.
You know, there's a handful of them and none of them are great.
Right. That's my feeling. So all the more reason why right now, if the Democratic leadership can't, as pro-Wall Street as they are, they don't figure out a way to grab hold of a story and a vision. I'm not confident about the future. Not at all.
But then again, you look at what happened in Virginia. You look at, well, New Jersey was expected. You look at Alabama.
Yeah.
And then again, Roy Moore was a special kind of heinous, you know, that you just can't make up someone like that. And
let me speak to the state I live in, Ryan State.
Okay. You're in Wisconsin.
Yeah, Wisconsin. Right. So Scott Walker is going to run again for governor.
He's not term limited out?
No, we don't have term limits like that. No,
oh,
no.
Wow.
And so, he's running now. The Democrats, there must be about a dozen Democrats seeking, you know what happens when a dozen people run for one office, and our primaries don't come up probably till I think in August or early, I mean, a very, very late primary. So the Democrats will compete with each other. But I've attended some of the candidates, you know, events and forums, and I can tell you right now that they're still not talking how to answer the class war, which has gone on in Wisconsin. You know, we had that, I don't know if you remember the Foxconn question, where Scott Walker and the Republicans have gifted $3 billion to the Foxconn Corporation to locate their offices and plant in southern Wisconsin, which happens to be inside of, I'm pretty sure, Ryan's district. Now, the Foxconn Corporation always makes promises and never fulfills. Basically, $3 billion in the state of Wisconsin, could probably give each citizen of the state $1 million just to enjoy rather than give $3 billion to these folks. I just don't know. Even in a state like Wisconsin, where we've been blue in the past, our red folk are hanging on.
And they just might, continue to hang on. There's a phenomenon that I call failing upwards. I used to see it in radio all the time, where the worst program director would keep getting better jobs and better jobs and better jobs just because they've been there and the name is familiar, I guess. That seems to happen. You know, I'm looking at Twitter while we're talking, and here's, I don't know who this Jed Sugarman is. Oh, he's a professor at Fordham Law School. He said the silver lining is that if they do ram this tax bill through next week, they'll be anchoring themselves to the most wildly unpopular legislation since modern polling began. And they will sink even further until they're wiped out in 2018, worse than child predator Roy Moore. The thing is, as you've been saying, Harvey, is the Democrats have to give them something to vote for. And that seems to be what we're lacking. I mean, right now, just saying, look, we'll do everything we can to undo what the Trumpers and the Republicans have been pushing through. But, you know, depending on who you're talking to, some people are still thinking that this is going to be a tax cut for them. And you know what? For the first couple of years, for people who get a paycheck every couple of weeks, it will be a tax cut for them. They don't realize that their tax cut's going to go away in a few years and they're going to be in worse shape because their insurance premiums are going to rise. They're not going to get their property tax deductions. If they live in any number of those states that have state and local income taxes, they're going to be hurt really badly. This is stuff that they're not taking into account.
Yeah, I mean, the optimism, I always get a kick out of the optimism of folks who live in California and New York. I mean, those are two Democratic states. I mean, I'm living in Wisconsin, and I can tell you that the immediate tax cuts people will benefit from, and then they're going to be pissed about the taxes that remain inside the state of Wisconsin. And Walker will say, well, we need to address these kind of things. I mean, people aren't going to say next year, I hated that tax bill.
No.
I'm going to vote for the Democrats. I mean, I read an article the other day, which was interesting, that basically, if you looked at the last election again, it was like people voting their hatreds.
Mm-hmm.
People voting their hatreds. So the question is, how do you transcend the hatreds? And the Republicans may well transcend it by saying, hey, look, we're going to give you a tax cut. The Democrats, what are they going to say?
As I said, I don't see anyone on the horizon that I'm excited about other than Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, to be honest.
Yeah, right. I'm with you.
But you give me anybody, you give me even a Cory Booker, who I'm not a fan of, I'm going to vote for him enthusiastically, anybody to get the Republicans and especially Donald Trump out of office.
Yeah, but that's me. I have no argument. I mean, I voted for Clinton when push came to shove.
So did I. And I think if you didn't, you were irresponsible. And I know a lot of my listeners didn't because they so hated her. And I think it came down to people despised her more than they feared the unknown of Donald Trump.
Yeah,
and they were thinking,
right.
Well, you know, he used to be a Democrat. He's given money to Democrats. He can't be that bad. And now they're seeing he's worse than they ever could have imagined.
Yes. Well, it's been good. I can hear the music coming up, so I can tell you it's been a pleasure talking to you again. even if it was just to have to vent and have to urge.
Well, anytime, Harvey J.K., it's always wonderful to talk with you. And it's,
well, that's really nice. I think in the new year I'm going to take you up on that kind
good.
Of stuff.
Good, I hope you do, because there's a lot to talk about. And again, I have a hard time some days getting myself motivated to come in here and do this show, because there's so much, it's so complicated, it's almost too difficult to boil down to a sound bite that you can easily riff on. And I get depressed.
So let me finish on a high note.
Okay.
Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas.
Happy Hanukkah and Merry Christmas to you as well. Harvey J.K., find him on Twitter at Harvey J.K., that's K-A-Y-E, and I'll put a link on the blog as well. Thank you so much, Harvey. Take care, Nicole.
We love you.
You too. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Harvey J.K., yes, he's a professor of democracy and justice. I love that title, at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and author of a couple of great books. And that's going to do it for us for today and for the week. Let's get Harvey back on more often, because we have good spirited conversations and it's good to commiserate with like-minded people. All right. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. I will talk to you again on Tuesday. As always, thank you for listening.